Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Roker Report podcast in association with Folks Brewery. I'm your host Alex as always and we'll be jumping straight into This Week in Football for Sunderland Association Football Club. On today's episode we'll be covering our loss in the Cup at the hands of Oxford United. Yesterday's 1-0 win against the extremely woeful Southend United, and we'll also be answering some fan questions on the matter before looking ahead to our Leasing.com tie with Leicester City's under-21s. I am joined in the studio today by Sam of Roker Report. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm all right, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, you know. I've plodding along. I've been a lot worse on these pods, given how recent things have gone.
Yeah, it could always be better, but could always be worse, couldn't it?
That's true. And we're also joined by the Chronicle's Craig Johns. How are you doing, Craig?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks.
What have you made of this last week in football for Sunderland?
Yeah, it's never dull, is it, at Sunderland? Of course, as well as matters on the pitch, we also had that investment news this week, which will hopefully be good news for Sunderland going forward. I don't think, just to quickly summarise, the defeat and the knockout of the Carabao Cup was a desperately poor thing for Sunderland. Of course, priorities in the league. And then they got back to winning ways in the league yesterday against Southend. So, yeah, an interesting week as always.
Yeah. It's never particularly dull, is it?
No, exactly.
No. I think we may just have a little bit of time, just a little bit, to talk about the small matter of the investment that is, as we have found out this week, finally being completed. But we'll start with a bit more of a dour topic before we get on to the more interesting ones. The loss in the Cup at the hands of Oxford. So as a brief summary of the game for those who weren't paying as much attention to it, if for whatever reason, Sunderland drew 1-1 with Oxford in normal time and weren't able to fulfil Jack Ross's long-awaited ambition of winning a game 1-1 because they, in fact, lost to Oxford on penalties, meaning that Oxford go through to the quarterfinals and will play Man City at home. So I'll start with you, Sam. Are we particularly bothered by this kind of game and this kind of result?
It's hard because straight after the game, I think you're more bothered. Obviously, when time goes by and you look back now, you're sort of not relieved because you want to win every game. Every Sunderland game you watch, you want to win, don't you? But I think at the time it was hard because I thought we played really well in the game. I thought second half we deserved to win it in normal time. Really, I think 09 should have had a penalty, and then that could be 2-1 easily. But no, I think obviously league's the priority, but you do want to win every game. So it was disappointing at the time, especially when you play so well. But obviously you can take positives when you play well. So that might have helped the players, if anything.
Yeah. And of course, as well, to maybe take the angle of the typical Sunderland fan that I am, is it the case that we were never really going to win this competition, so we should just be focusing on the league and we should just be quite content to put that fixture behind us?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And you look who Oxford have drawn in the next round and you might have been a decent day out, but you would have more than likely got battered off Man City. So is it better to go out the way we did with arguably our heads held high than a big defeat in midweek in the middle of two league games? Could have been better for us if you think about it.
Just to kind of jump in there as well, I think in the Carabao Cup, you consider the kind of bigger implications of financial as well. Of course, in the Carabao Cup now, you don't get any financial benefit of progressing until you get to the semi-final, which, as we've said, because of the draw with Manchester City, the likelihood is that there wouldn't be progression to the semi-final. Whereas, for example, in the FA Cup, again, it's not going to be the priority. But the more you progress in the FA Cup, you get extra money for every round. So potentially more incentive to progress in that competition.
Is there an argument to be made, though, Craig, that even though, you know, you wouldn't see the money come in as like a bonus for getting that far, there would be a lot earned from the revenue of getting Man City at home?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there would be that kind of revenue if there was, you know, enough people attending the game. I'm sure there would be because it's Man City. But on the grand scheme of things, you know, we saw last season the build-up of fixtures and everything else. I think, you know, with this new investment coming into the club as well, it's what you would get on gate receipts would be minor in comparison. So better to focus attention elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the actual game itself against Oxford, what were your general thoughts on it, Craig?
Well, I thought, obviously, Phil Parkinson went three at the back to start off with. And, you know, we saw Jack Ross try that in pre-season and then the first two games of the season. And it didn't work then. Phil Parkinson's obviously a new manager now, so completely fair that he wanted to experiment with that and try it out himself. And I think not just experimenting, but it was also quite a necessity because, of course, we're short on wingers at the moment, with Lyndon Gooch out injured, Duncan Watmore missed the game with a virus. Of course, Chris Maguire was suspended. So Aidan McGeady was pretty much the only fit natural winger they had available on the night. So the way that he set it up allowed Aidan McGeady to go into a number 10 role, a bit of a free role, which I think a lot of people wanted to try and see him in as well. And I'm sure Phil Partington wanted to too. But for me, that formation just doesn't work for Sunderland. They looked very disjointed. They just looked like they didn't really understand what they were doing. I think to play that system, you need good defenders who can play the ball out from the back. And you know, I'm a big fan of Joe Lynch. I think he's been exceptional since he came in, but he probably had his worst game since coming to the club on Tuesday night at Oxford. He really struggled with that. And I think he's usually very composed on the ball. So whether or not that system change was a factor in that, I don't know. But it certainly looked that way.
Now, these might be early days for Sunderland. And obviously, there are going to be teething problems with any new manager. They're going to try new things, as you've said there. They're going to experiment. And not everything's going to go perfectly straight away. That's just a thing that is always the case in football. But when you look at the game, and I know Sam touched on this, would you argue that on another day, you know, we could have very easily won that? I mean, you had a penalty appeal waved away. Max Power missed that complete sitter. So, you know, let's say that those two chances do go our way and we convert, we win that game 3-1, you know, if everything else stays the same. So is there an argument to be made there that, you know, despite the new manager's transition and all of the consequences that come with that, we are still looking pretty good? It is still looking promising based on what we did in that game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I mentioned the negatives there of going three at the back. That didn't work for me. But like you rightly say, I mean, Mark McNulty hit the post just before Oxford got their opener. He then set Max Power up for that sitter. And that was when there were still three at the back. Joe Lynch as well, I didn't see it at the time because of where the press box is in Oxford. And it's right at the other end of where the penalty happened. We've mentioned the late Luke 09 one, but there was also the Joe Lynch one where the keeper came through, completely missed the ball and took Joe Lynch out. I mean, that was a stonewall penalty in itself as well. So, I mean, you take that penalty, you take the late Luke 09 penalty, Max Power should bury his chance at the end of the first half. There were plenty of positives, and certainly when they went back to four at the back in the second half, I think it was 55th minute, Will Grigg came on, Joe Lynch went off, and Sunderland completely controlled the game from then on. Bearing in mind, Oxford were the informed team going into that game as well, and I think definitely there are positives to take. And the thing that I've enjoyed so much about since Phil Partington's come, the results, Tranmere and yesterday against Southend aside, haven't necessarily come yet, but Sunderland are always looking to be on the front foot. There's a lot of attacking intensity now within that team, and yeah, I just think it's generally a lot more positive and a lot better to watch since Phil Partington's come in. Mm-hmm.
Going back to you here, Sam, now, so far in his career, Phil Partington is overseen three losses hitherto. He's overseen the Wickham game, which we lost 1-0, the game away to Shrewsbury, and of course, we lost on penalties to Oxford, which is, by all accounts, another loss.
Yeah.
But based on how we've played that game, as Craig said, we've played with a lot of attacking intent, and we have looked to control games, and you would argue that we've, for the most part, succeeded in doing so. So despite the results on paper not looking particularly rosy as of yet, is there a lot of reason to assume that Sunderland under Phil Partington are a very promising prospect?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Even you go back to the Shrewsbury game, and we're desperately unlucky in that game. I think we hit the post or bar three times, and their goal just came from a cross in the box. He hits it on the turn first time. It could happen any time, you know, and Oxford was the same. I mean, Craig touched on it. We were like inches away from going 1-0 up, and they hit us on the counter-attack and make a 1-0 themselves, which it's desperately unlucky. And I think the two away games, bar Wickham, I think we deserve to get beat off Wickham, but he'd only been in the job a day. Mm-hmm. I think we've been desperately unlucky. And like Craig said, not counting Wickham, I think every game we've played under Partington, we've been the better team and on the front foot, which under Ross, especially the away games, like you look at Lincoln and even Bolton and stuff, that wasn't the case at all. We would have been lucky to get stuff from games like Lincoln, which under Partington, yeah, we've lost against Shrewsbury and Oxford, but we were just desperately unlucky. And that was the thing under Ross. People would say, yeah, we might grind out results, but it's the performances. We're just not there. And I think under Partington, we're lucky to have turned that round.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get into more about Parkinson and just what he's doing with the Sunderland side at the moment and all the strengths and weaknesses that we've identified so far. But before we do get onto that and the Tranmere and the South End game itself, let's talk a bit about the small matter of the investment. So that's finally been completed, Craig. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it looks like a good thing going forward. We know these three Americans are quite serious. They actually looked at a number of other clubs in England. They've been interested in coming into English football for quite some time now. And I think it says a lot about the state of Sunderland Football Club right now that, you know, yes, initially it was going to be a takeover. Then it was going to be some investment where they would take some shares. Now they've just invested in Stuart Donald's Madrox company for the time being. They don't have any shares to show for that. But despite all of that, they've put an eight-figure sum into the club. There is still interest there. You know, like I say, they looked at other clubs. They looked at Newcastle United. They looked at Chelsea. I know they looked at Watford. And there was a few others they looked at. For various reasons, they walked away. With Sunderland, whatever's happened that has reduced the impact of what this investment is right now, they are still there. They've put money in. They still obviously believe that something is worthwhile going forward investing in Sunderland. And yeah, that eight-figure sum can go towards some very important things for the club. Mm-hmm.
Now, I was at a talk in Town End on the Friday night of just last week with Charlie Methven and Kevin Ball. And one of the things that Charlie said in the sort of opening exchanges of that discussion with regards to the investment is that when you look at a club like Sunderland and you look at all of the big clubs in English football, we are one of the few big clubs, to use that term as a sort of like a metric, we're one of the few big clubs that has yet to have substantial investment of the type that, say, Man City and Man United and, you know, teams of the like have. We're one of the few that hasn't. So is it perhaps to see a club like Sunderland in League One, you know, a club of that sheer potential, is that what, you know, the investors see when they look at Sunderland? If you look at clubs in and around the Football League, there's only really us and Leeds that I think have that sort of that real, like, ceiling to be shattered, so to speak. Is it the case that we are, out of all those teams, the biggest one for potential?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as I mentioned, they did look at other Premier League clubs. They've been looking at like a few English clubs. You know, they looked at Watford and felt that if they went into Watford, they would potentially need to build a new stadium. Same with Chelsea. If they went to Chelsea, they would probably have to build a new stadium. Newcastle United, Mike Ashley wants a very big price for that, but also their academy is in training facilities are in dire need of a big revamp there. So that would have cost a lot of money on top of the price they would have had to buy. Sunderland, you've got the stadium alight. There's potential to expand that if you need to in the future. There's the Academy of Light. The facilities at the Academy of Light are absolutely top notch. And because Sunderland are in League One, Stuart Donald and Charlie Methven and co. have come in. They've sorted out the club to make it more sustainable financially. And because it's a League One club, it's available for a much lower price. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense from an investment point of view.
Mm-hmm. May it be the case that the main obstacles sort of preventing Sunderland from receiving an investor prior to Donald Methven and co. sort of taking over was the issue before that while the facilities were very good, the club, because it was run quite inefficiently, you know, to say little else, was that a problem? Was it the case of perhaps the buying out by putting money into the club for transfer funds is just the tip of a very sort of like financially detrimental iceberg.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you looked at Sunderland and Stuart Donald and Charlie Methven have spoken a lot about it since they've come. You know, the club had, of course, crippling debts, massive bank loans, but not just that, it was the kind of the expenditure that the club had on things that really they didn't need to be spending on. One of the famous examples is the plant pots at the Stadium of Light, which I think was at £2 million a year or something like that. It was costing the club. And there was just little things like that where, because of the kind of lack of care that was going into the club under Ellis Short's ownership, these things were just going through and the club were just spending needless money on needless things. And yes, it took a lot of cuts, you know, redundancies and things like that had to come. And you mentioned the talking that Charlie Methven did on Friday night. I was there myself, and you know, he spoke about how nobody likes to make them cuts, and that's it. It's not a part of something that people enjoy doing when they go into a new business, making the cuts. But they've done them cuts now. Sunderland are in a much more financially stable position now. And now, rather than looking to make cuts, they can start looking the other way now on where they're going to spend money and how they're going to improve the club.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, like maybe to sort of continue expanding on that point, I'll go to you now, Sam. What do you think the positive implications are for the club now that money has come in? As we've said there, it's an eight-figure sum. It's been injected directly into the club. We now have said money at the club. The club now has said money at its disposal, you know, to my understanding, as far as I'm aware. What are now the positive implications? We're finished with cutting back now, in, you know, you would hope. Yeah. Sort of cuts have been made for the greater good. What is the greater good now?
I think one of the main things for me is just the fact that we've had confirmation. You know, we're not in the dark anymore. We had fans saying, oh, they're not interested, they're umming and ahhing. But like Craig said, the fact that they've put the money in without being a takeover or whatever, it shows the intent and it shows they're interested. So I think that's the main thing for me, especially when, like you say, they were looking at Premier League clubs and all sorts. And it was like you said, Alex, I think they do see, you'd be daft not to see a team like Sunderland in League One. And if you had the money to think, we could turn that club around, we could be the heroes, whatever. And I think that's the main thing for me. It shows that there is light at the end of the tunnel, that he's getting better. And the fans who doubted Stuart and Charlie should be thinking now that they're in the wrong, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stuart and Charlie are football men. If there's two things that can be said about them, they are both football men. They are both lifelong fans of Oxford United. They've been in this game, you know, a long time, albeit prior to Sunderland at a lower level. But they've been in sort of business management on the business management side of football a very long time, and they've obviously overseen a lot of changes, a lot of positive ones at Eastleigh. So to have those two, I would say, in charge, the only thing that was lacking significantly to maybe get us on the magic carpet ride that we've all pined for years upon years would be a substantial investment. You know, it was no secret that when they first took over that, you know, the Ellis Short's billions were no longer a commodity the club could just chuck around haphazardly. You know, we had to play it safe, we had to play it smart. We had to do some necessary evils like cutting back. But as we've said there, it's for now, you know, it's to allow us to sort of see the sunnier pastures of what we have now. Now, obviously, Mickey Dell and co, they won't be football men. And that's something that I think, again, isn't much of a secret, that they aren't people who are lifelong fans of English football clubs like Donald and Methven are. But the fact of the matter is that with the investment in the hands of football men, what we have is we have the answer to the problem we were initially faced with when we saw the appointment of Donald and Methven. Well, not their appointment, the taking over of Donald and Methven. With Ellis Short, you had basically a billionaire who had the best intentions but wasn't a football man. What we have now are two men who are football men with money of a similar ilk at this level, relatively speaking, at their disposal. So if I go back to you here, Craig, can that only be a good thing?
Yeah, of course it can. I think you're exactly right. Donald and Methven are football men. I mean, I think, as you rightly mentioned, it's a different scale that they've previously been used to Sunderland. And have they made mistakes since they've been here? Of course they've made mistakes, and I'm sure they'd be man enough to stand up and admit that they've made some mistakes because of the size of Sunderland in comparison to the clubs that they've previously been in charge of. But that said, they are football people. they have the right people around them as well. And I think they genuinely do have the best interests of the club going forward. And like you rightfully say, with money being trusted to them, it should be in better care than what it was in the previous regime where, as you rightly said, Ellis Short kind of trusted the wrong people at the top of the club and money was thrown about quite haphazardly.
Yeah, obviously we had Ellis Short employing people like Martin Bain, giving Martin Bain full control to sort of oversee everything. And, you know, thanks to Netflix, the whole world can see that the rest was history because we are where we are as a consequence of you know, you would say cumulative neglect and sort of, you know, if we're being dramatic, you would call it gross negligence because a lot of things that went on in the prior regime were just sort of, you know, beyond unacceptable, really. But I suppose that's a story that was then and, you know, we can now focus on now, which thanks to what's happened this week is looking an awful lot better. So I think we'll now move on to the Southend game. So just as a quick summary for those who haven't seen it or weren't there to watch it or listen, you didn't miss too much, really, if we're being perfectly honest. Sunderland won 1-0, but the game wasn't a very glamorous one. We scored a lovely goal thanks to a Denver Hume cross, which Luke O'Nine superbly, with a diving header, knocked into the bottom right corner to make it 1-0. But despite Sunderland keeping the pressure on and despite Southend being, you know, to put it quite mildly, a poor team, the game stayed 1-0. There were no more goals to be seen, and all of Sunderland's attacks broke down with the final ball quite frustratingly. But regardless, a win's a win. 3 points is 3 points, and they all count. It's worth as much as Doncaster 7-1 rout of them. So let's have the three-word review from the good people of Twitter to summarise this game, and then we'll have a little chat about it. So Graham says Dobson's lovely hair. John Stacey says McGeady shocking again. Bomber says 09 Ballon d'Or. Janie M says Luke 09. Mark Mason says fell into coma. Mrs. Thubbs says it wasn't pretty. Anne Caldwell says job done, just. Jake Collinson says a drab win. Steve N says consecutive diving headers. And John Ralph says not promotion candidates. So I'll start with you, Sam, for this one. Just what were your thoughts on the Southend game? Coming away from it, how do you feel about it?
Well, there's the two ways to look at it, isn't there? There's obviously, like you said, a win's a win and you never... We're never ever going to, I don't care what league, we'll turn our noses up as a win, in a win, do you know what I mean? It's 3 points on the board, like you say. You look back at the end of the season, it's the same as if we'd beat them 4-0. I know, obviously, goal difference is different, but then there's the other side where they were one of the worst teams I've seen at the stadium. I think we should have beat them by more goals, and it just sends a bit of a statement, like what happened against Tranmere. Everyone was buzzing, do you know what I mean? And I think, looking back, it should have been more, but like you say, a win's a win, so you walked away from it with 3 points and another clean sheet at home. That's two in a row in the Partington, which is obviously a plus. So it's 3 points and you move on to the next game, really, at the end of the day.
Well, I am going to play devil's advocate with you there, Sam, because despite winning the game, I wasn't entirely satisfied, being the cynic that I am.
Yeah.
Now, okay, you won 1-0, right? You won, you've got 3 points. As I've said there, they're worth the same as when Doncaster beat them 7-1. It's worth 3 points, just like when Leicester beat Southampton 9-0. It's all worth the same. But regardless, I'm worried because despite how much pressure we put on them, despite all of the forward runs and forward passes that we saw from Parkinson Sunderland yesterday, we could only manage one goal past them despite all of that pressure and despite just how bad they were. Because let's face it, they were a terrible team. Like they barely looked... They didn't even look that bothered to me. I just think they were sloppy in possession. They couldn't string passes together. When they got forward, they were toothless. You know, that game was there for the taking. You could have put me in charge and I would have won you that game. And I feel like I might have won you more than 1-0 because I just reckon, given how much we've got at our disposal there with that team, we should be beating Southend more than 1-0. So I'll go to you now, Craig. Is that a concern that we're only putting one goal past such a poor team given how attacking our players?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think the invention in particular in the final third, the creativity is a real issue. We mentioned a little earlier that they're a little light on forwards at the minute. Wingers not readily available as you might want. And the, as I say, the invention, the creativity in the final third just isn't quite there at the moment. Not just that, there was actually yesterday quite rare that there was a lot of good crosses I thought went into the box. Southend's defence, they played a three at the back with the two wing backs, and that allowed for Sunderland's two wing backs, Denver Hume and Conor McLaughlin, to get forward quite often during the game, and I thought the pair of them put in some very good crosses into the box. The issue is you've only really got Will Grigg in there, and his natural game isn't really to be, if you like, the target man striker. He's very good, Will Grigg, in his career previously before Sunderland, at kind of making runs in the box, running across the defender to the front post or getting in at the back post. And if you looked at his actual statistics in his career prior to Sunderland, you'd see that he actually scored a lot of headed goals, but it was all based on, you know, his movement and getting ahead of defenders and things like that. Now, the issue is, if the ball's going in and not finding Will Grigg, well, then there needs to be somebody else there. So if Will Grigg's making the movement at the front post, if it goes over Will Grigg's head, who's at the back post? Mm-hmm. Sunderland just didn't really have that yesterday, and the ball never seemed to find Will Grigg in the box, but there was never anybody else around him where they were found from the crosses either. And I think in fairness to Southend, we see how bad they were, and there wasn't a lot of intent from them, and you're right, they were pretty sloppy in possession. I think you mentioned the defeat to Doncaster and things like that, but of course now Sol Campbell's come in and he's had a bit of time to work with that defence. I mean, there were times yesterday where Sol Campbell was pretty much playing in defence himself. He was he was so involved in the play, he was half on the pitch, and his intention and his focus was solely on their back line, and he was constantly shouting instructions, constantly organising their defence. And I think, in fairness to them, they were quite good defensively. They didn't open up, they didn't leave too many gaps for Sunderland, and that's when Sunderland's invention comes into it. It's the onus is on them to break Southend down, and they didn't really create many clear-cut chances after the goal. I mean, I tweeted after it went 1-0 and said this could be like, they've got that early goal, that's always important, this could be like Tranmere now, because Southend will need to change their game and go after the game a bit more. But actually they didn't, they just seemed intent to kind of keep the scoreline down. And I guess if you're looking at it from Southend's perspective, they're kind of taking small baby steps under Sol Campbell. So to them yesterday, coming to Sunderland, coming to the Stadium of Light and only losing 1-0, bearing in mind, you know, before the game they had the worst defence in the league, mm-hmm. you know, that's a positive for them to take from that. It's small baby steps that they're making, so they're growing confidence from the fact that they restricted Sunderland to very few clear-cut chances.
Oh, undoubtedly they'll be happy with that, I think, you know, given how bad recent results have gone for them, just how sort of humiliating some scorelines have been. To come to the Stadium of Light, which, let's face it, we've said it before, but it's true nonetheless. It's like a cup final for the average League One away contingent. You know, it's a 49,000 seater stadium. You've come here, you've only lost 1-0. You've given, you know, as far as a defensive performance goes, a good account of yourself. I don't rate them much elsewhere, but I think you're right. I think Sol Campbell has had a bit of time, and they were quite well organised. But what I will say again, and it's the cynic in me talking, but I just think that because we only have the one striker, and because a lot of our attacks were very samey and there wasn't much variation, that we were quite predictable. So that while Southend, I think, did defend resiliently against what we had to offer, I think once they got used to one kind of attack, they were more or less used to all of them. More or less every attack in the first half was a sequence of someone gets the ball to Hume. Hume makes a good run, and I'll get onto him later because I thought he was brilliant regardless of this. He makes a good run. McGeady's on the overlap, he squares it to McGeady. McGeady does that thing where, like, he feints and then runs to the byline, then swings it in, or he knocks it back to Hume, and then one of them will swing it into the path of Grigg. But of course, Grigg's then surrounded by three centre backs who are all about 6'3" or above. So, you know, ultimately, if that is what we are offering up to a team when we're going on the offensive, they're not going to have much bother defending against us. And indeed, the only time that we did score in that game was thanks to a very, very good cross and a very, very good header from Luke O'Nine. Had that little shot of quality been missing from that game, it could have easily have been 0-0. And if we were talking about a 0-0 now, I'd be fuming, because there is no way you should be drawing at home to a team where you're so much better than them like that. But it did just take a very good piece of play to win you the game. But those are rare in League One, because that was a very good goal and a very good cross. And we don't really have that normally. I don't know, what do you make of our sort of creativity, Sam? Like, what is it that we need in that team? If it's a new striker, is it a new approach? What is it that we're just needing just to make sure that those 1-0 wins just become a bit more satisfying for us with maybe a 2-0 or a 3-0 instead?
Well, I do understand the negativity around Greg, because I know he looks lethargic. It's not working for him. He doesn't look, and he probably is, but he doesn't look too bothered on the pitch. But there was a few times yesterday where I saw him get the ball on the edge of the box and he would pop it off to say O'Neill or Maguire. And he does make, as soon as he's popped it off, he spins around the corner and he makes a slightly intelligent run, but we never seem to give it straight back to him or something. We always seem to, because it's working out wide, we'll get the ball around the box, right? Who's free on the wing? Is it Hume? Is it McGeady? Is it McLaughlin? And I just think he looks frustrated, because he does, I do watch him, he does make them good runs that he must have been making for Wigan and they just pop it off to him. And it should take someone like Max Power to say, look, I've worked with him before, he's making the runs, just giving in to him, because that's, like Craig said, that's his game. One, two touches in the box, goal. It's not running onto a cross whipped in, it's not holding up the ball. We're not playing to his strengths, and I don't know if that's the tactics or Greg, because it's under two managers now, so you've got to question him as well. But I think someone said yesterday, it would have been, I know he's not the most talented, but the crosses we were put in yesterday, it would have been a great game for someone like Charlie White, just bulldozing his way in the box, really. So we're unlucky on that side that he wasn't playing, but you've got to play it to the strength of the players you've got on the pitch, really.
I was actually going to say after that one thing I was saying at the game yesterday to my dad, that when I was watching those crosses, I was like, you know what, I think if you had someone of Charlie White's sort of like style of play and stature, then you could, I think those crosses were sort of like, you might say were instructed by Parkinson for a target man in mind, not for Will Grigg, who's a lot more of like your poacher, a lot more of your sort of like, you know, like your man spearheading the attacks when the ball's coming along the ground. But again, I'm not convinced by Charlie White though either. And I know I'm sort of like on like a rampage of just like negativity here, just like saying time and time again. But like, you know, at the end of the day, if Charlie White, say hypothetically, was to come back into the fold, and let's say he wasn't, despite the style of play, to keep scoring, I would love him to, and I really want him to. But let's say that he didn't. What would be the solution then? Would we have to maybe change the number of strikers on the pitch? Would we have to go and buy in January? What do you think, Craig? What would you think would be the best approach?
I mean, it would be excellent to go out and buy in January, but of course January is a difficult window to make moves in anyway. And as Sunderland found last January when Josh Madger went, getting in a striker in January isn't easy, and you're not going to be able to do it on the cheap. I think there is more than capable players there. You know, you mentioned like with the crosses yesterday, there was a couple I can think of where Will Grigg, like maybe the headers glanced off the top of his head, they were just slightly. So it comes down to if Charlie White was in there, it wouldn't necessarily be an issue of quality. It would just be completely physical attributes. He's just that little bit bigger than Grigg, so instead of glancing off the top of White's head, there would have been meeting his forehead dead on, and then it would have come down to his quality and whether he had the ability to turn that header into the back of the net, or certainly at least on target and test the goalkeeper. And I think we've mentioned that invention and that creativity, you know, like, yesterday they did exploit the wings a lot because of Southend's system. The fullbacks could bomb on a lot because Southend played that five at the back with the two wing backs. There was no wingers, so that allowed Sunderland's two wing backs or fullbacks to get forward a lot. And that's where a lot of the space was in the game. But yeah, I think you just have to mix it up slightly a bit. I think that was Sunderland's issue yesterday, as you rightfully said. Like, you could kind of write the script of just about every Sunderland attack, and it was down the wing, swing the ball in, and they just didn't quite mix things up enough. I think because he's just coming back from a virus, which is why he didn't start, but having someone like a Duncan Watmore yesterday would have been really helpful, because maybe even would have been a case for Mark McNulty to have started, because they just do something different. They don't mind getting on the ball. They can maybe come inside a bit more. We saw in the Tranmere game the way Will Grigg and Duncan Watmore linked up well with each other, because Duncan Watmore doesn't mind coming inside. And his goal against Tranmere, he gave the ball to Grigg. Grigg then squared it back with a reverse pass to Watmore, who'd made that intelligent run in behind the defence. And it's just mixing your play up a bit like that, and it makes it unpredictable. I think one of the big successes Sunderland Sunderland did have against Southend was on that left wing with McGeady and Hume, where they did now and then mix things up. So every now and then they would play the pass with each other, 1-2, get down the wing and put the ball in. But every now and then McGeady would fake the pass and come inside. Now, you're still only having a long range shot when you do that, but you're mixing things up, and it just caused Southend one or two problems when they did do that. They just probably didn't do it enough on the day.
It's just a variation, I think. I think while the attacks that they do coordinate, I think they do very well. I think our passing game under Parkinson's been excellent. I mean, as we get on in games, as we start to tire from, you know, continued attacks, we do look a bit more lethargic. But I'm prepared to be okay with that if you're spending most of the game on the offensive, you know, like just grafting your boots off for the sake of getting as many goals as you can, because that's what we all want to see. I think the passing game is very, very good for the most part. I really do. But if there's just a bit more variation, then it counts more. You know, if the other team, if you can pass the ball well and keep the other team guessing, then you know, you're really, that's the kind of setup and system and quality that promotion winning teams are made of, because those are the teams that can you know, blow apart others when they need to. And I think you're right, Craig. I think that just changing it up, to put it bluntly, is what we missed. It's what we missed yesterday. But let's get on now to topics that are completely, in essence, positive ones. Because I've made you all talk about Will Griggs and Charlie White and whoever's shortcomings enough. Let's start with Duncan Watmore, and we'll work back from the players who came off the bench to the ones who started. So we'll start with Watmore. When he came on, he looked like a revelation to me. He looked really, really good. How good did you think he was, Sam?
It was, I think, like Craig said, it was unlucky that he couldn't start the game, because he does offer that something different where he can run to the byline, swing it in, or he can just go so direct. I think there was a run where he beat about three or four players. He had a shot on his left foot that didn't look too far away. I know the keeper didn't move, so I might have to watch that back. But that's what, it's all about variation, like you said. Because Southend look quite content with, right, they've got space out wide, but we're just going to attack the ball and head it out. Whereas Watmore came on, and it looked like they were expecting him to do what McGeady and Hume were doing. He just ran at them, which we haven't got many players who can do that. I know Gooch is quite direct, but Watmore, in terms of just running towards the goal, is going to be a defender's nightmare in League One, because they're not used to that. They're used to just heading balls out of the box all the time, like what Southend were doing. So I think a big positive in the last few weeks is Watmore, because whether it's starting or coming off the bench, he is offering something different and he is helping us in games. So that's great to see as well for him on a personal level, because he's been through all sorts in the past couple of years. So it's great to see him be back in amongst it. He looks fit, doesn't he? So
he does.
Great to see.
I think he offers as well. I mean, on the topic of keeping opposition guessing, he offers two different avenues when you're going forward. As you said there, Sam, when he does get forward, like he took on about four men and had a shot, and albeit the shot missed, but you know, that's just what we want to see. You know, it gets bums off seats, and it's like for an opposition it'd be a nightmare, because you don't know what's coming next. But as well as that, there were a few times when he had balls over the top that he chased down into the box, and his first touch was phenomenal. And he did well to recover balls that a lot of wingers in this division would either miss or would let go. But he managed to bring them back and recover play. And then from there, he's in a good position to get the ball to someone who's in a goal-scoring position. So I think on two different fronts, Watmore, you know, could provide two different sources. What do you think, Craig?
Yeah, I think exactly right. I think Sam touched on some good points there, that how direct he is. He obviously has a lot of pace. I mean, he had them two bad injuries, and you kind of worry that they might affect that. But as he's getting more match sharp, it looks like that hasn't been affected at all. It's still there. And as you see, he is getting more sharp. He's getting a little run of games since Parkinson come in. And so his touch is improving. His confidence on the pitch is improving, because it must really affect you when he was coming back as he was after the two bad injuries. And then in the last year, 12 to 18 months, he's been free of the knee injury, because his legs weren't used to playing at that high competitive level. He was just constantly picking up these little frustrating muscle injuries, and he had a little run in the team at the end of last season, and then of course had the bad tackle at Wickham, having just scored a late equaliser as well, from that ultimate height, and then knowing you're out for the rest of the season again. Like it must really affect your confidence, and to see Duncan now getting a little run of games, getting that little bit of match sharpness back, you can see, as I say, the confidence in his own body as well. It's a real positive because Sunderland don't have a lot of pace in that forward line and they don't have many players who are as direct as he is. So when we talk about invention and we talk about doing something different, what more offers that?
What, speaking of pace then, what about Denver Hume? Because he played very well as well, I thought.
Yeah, well, I thought yesterday what Sunderland needed was players like that because there was times where Denver Hume was getting the ball, dribbling, and I think he's close ball control when it's at his feet at times is absolutely exceptional. I mean, I've been critical at times of Hume for his positional sense in defending, and often his crosses has been quite poor as well. Not the case yesterday, but in the past, the Shrewsbury in particular, I thought he was quite wasteful with crosses. But certainly dribbling, I've never had any issue with his dribbling at all. As when he gets the ball at his feet, he glides down that left wing and he's really tidy. I think we mentioned the Watmore one, but there was one with Hume in the second half as well, where he kind of went on a little run, somehow ended up in the box, and his shot was just deflected behind for a corner. But his Southend, we've mentioned the crosses, they had the big lads at the back who were just happy to attack and head out any ball that came in the box. What they looked frightened of was players like Watmore, players like Hume, who ran at them and looked to take them on. They weren't comfortable at that, and just the issue for Sunderland was is they didn't have many players who could do that. But yeah, Hume was brilliant yesterday. I think it was probably his best game for Sunderland.
Mm-hmm. I think every time, I mean, it will ultimately help you when you are playing against a team that's low on confidence and low on quality, which Southend had both in abundance. But when you're playing in a game like that, I think for Hume's confidence, it must be great because he has an opportunity there playing against a weaker side in this league to take players on. And, you know, did he not? Like, I think he saw the chance when he was sort of breaking through, either going down the wing or cutting inside into like the middle of the park. But when he did, he looked so promising. I don't really think he gave the ball away once.
No, he was really strong yesterday, and as you rightly say, that confidence grows throughout the game because you can see Southend offer very little. And the one big thing about the way Phil Partington sets this team up is to allow the fullbacks to go forward, because you have George Dobson and Max Power doing very important positions in the team, so they might often sit quite deep midfield. The fullbacks bomb forward, but then you've always got Max Power or George Dobson who can drop in and cover if you are found a little far forward and you give the ball away. But see, yesterday that wasn't really too much of an issue because Southend didn't have much intent when it came to going forward. But certainly there's a lot of confidence growing in Hume. You can see he's getting better every game. And we spoke to him after the game yesterday, actually. He was talking about how Partington's organising things on the training pitches and every player's going out now with a clear understanding of exactly what their role is.
And was that not there before?
He didn't see it, but it was implied that that was the case, and now he's got that kind of freedom to excel in what he enjoys doing, which is going forward, mm-hmm. because he knows that there are them two central midfielders there who can drop in and cover.
Yeah, so he's now got a lot more leeway to be like an out-and-out wing-back, so to speak, rather than maybe being somewhere between a wing-back and a full-back, depending on the formation or the context of the game. He now has a set role, and would you say that just based on the game like yesterday, if let's say he's a wing back every game this season, you know, will he only improve?
Yeah, I think so, because I think that's definitely his strength is going forward. He mentioned when he was younger, he used to play left wing. That was more his position. And then just in recent years, he's kind of dropped back to being a fullback. So he appreciates he has, you know, plenty to improve on, particularly defensively. But he's doing that and he's growing game by game. I know plenty of people have spoken in the past about whether he and Aidan McGeady can play it together, because Aidan McGeady perhaps leaves him a bit vulnerable at the back at times. And, you know, we might say that more against better opposition who have a bit more intent than what Southend did. But as I say, because now those important roles that the two central midfielders are playing, it just gives Hume that bit more freedom to do what he does best, and that's going forward.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So we'll take a very quick break here from the match discourse because we have yet another competition. This week, our mate David Wright offered our followers a Red and White Legends 2012 caricature. Is that how you say that word? I don't know how you say that word. Is it caricature?
Caricature,
yeah. Well, basically, David Wright offered our friends a Red and White Legends 2020 character calendar, and we are in a charitable mood, as always, so we are giving away three of them. So if your handles are any of the following handles for Twitter, Instagram, or whatever it may be, then you are one of the three lucky people. So first of all, we have an Instagram follower by the handle of CallumMac93. One is a Twitter follower, TommyBoyd97, and one is for a Facebook follower by the name of Linda Roberts. So if you're one of those people, please DM the Roker Report on either Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, you know, whichever one's corresponding best to you. Give us the contact details and we will get that to you as soon as we can. You have until 6 p.m. on Friday, as always, or Tom Albrighton will eat your calendar, because that's what he does. If you don't claim your prize, we'll feed them to him and he takes them. That's what happens. He's normally here in the studio with us, but if he listens to this back, then he'll know that I've kept that joke going. Anyway, we're going to move on now to some questions from the listeners. So relating to yesterday's game, we asked on Twitter yesterday for if anyone had any questions that we could answer today about anything to do with the Southend game or beyond. So the first one comes from Ryan Pullman. I was going to mention Luke 09 in the previous conversation there about who played well, but I figured I'll leave it and let Ryan start with his question, which is Luke 09, future Sunderland captain. That's all the question is. What's the answer, Sam?
I could say that, yeah. I know obviously he's only young and he sometimes comes across a bit younger than he actually is with his enthusiasm and everything, but just everything about him off the pitch is spot on. I mean, I watch these, the behind the scenes videos that the clubs do, and even when he's walking down the steps, he goes and shakes everyone's hand. He looks dead happy to be there all the time, which is exactly what you want when you love the club as much as we do. You want to see someone who shares that with you. And he's always training hard. And you see him sometimes on the pitch with kids after. He's just great, and he's got ability as well. I mean, he's improved massively since when we first signed him. It probably is confidence, but he can play in a number of roles now. I mean, I know Conor McLaughlin played quite well yesterday, but I still think O'Line's the best right back in the club to date. He's great in centre midfield. He can play in the number 10. He can even play out wide. And he never seems to, if he gets put out wide, for example, say you would never imagine him to be in a huff about it or anything. He's just happy to be on the pitch, and I think he looks like he's living the dream of every fan, really, which is exactly what you want. It's great to see. Like, we've been through years of having the likes of Dylan Bodgy and Coley and Dog and
Yanazai.
The list goes on, which is depressing, but talking about O'Neill, it's just what we've wanted to see for years, and it's great to finally have it. And I could see him being a captain in years to come. Yeah,
what do you think, Craig?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, there's more characteristics to being a captain than just what you produce on the pitch, or because dependent on how he is behind the scenes and on the training pitches would depend on whether he's a good captain. But I think one of the things certainly Jack Ross wanted to do in his recruitment in the summer, and what he tasked the scouts with doing, was kind of signing a lot of leaders. And you saw in Sunderland's recruitment, nearly every player they signed had previously been a captain at other clubs. And that's something Jack Ross wanted to build in his Sunderland squad, was characteristics and mentality of being leaders on the pitch. And Luke 09 certainly is one of them. I think he is the epitome of the club's recruitment at this level, where it should have been. It wasn't always right that first summer that Luke came in. You know, they didn't get everything right recruitment-wise, but it was all very rushed. We know the squad was threadbare that summer, and they needed to just put a squad together essentially for League One. But you know, Luke 09 is the epitome of where, when Sunderland are in League One, and even when they go up to the Championship, the kind of player they should be looking at. You know, he was at a good age where there's still a lot of potential to develop into a better player. There's nothing saying that in a few years Luke 09 can't keep developing and become a very good Championship player, maybe even a Premier League player, who knows. That could look optimistic now, but you don't know how much he could develop in the future. Not just that, but because of where he was prior to that, he came to Sunderland knowing that this was a huge opportunity for him. And as Sam rightly said, he just looks like he absolutely loves every minute of what he does at the club, not just on the pitch, but all of it, the support he gets from the fans and everything like that. So to me, a player like Luke 09 is the epitome of where Sunderland's recruitment should be at.
Paul O'Brien asks, 15 games gone, do you think promotion is still a realistic target, whether it be automatic or via the playoffs? Back to you, Sam.
Yeah, I do. I mean, even like we've said, you look at the games under Partlington, we've improved massively, in my opinion. So I think you always want to be optimistic. I didn't say we're going to win the league or whatever, but at the very least, based on form at the minute, it's looking like playoffs, isn't it? And then you never know if you get, say, fourth or fifth around Christmas when all the games are coming in, why can't you kick on and win the league or get second? I mean, you look at Luton last year, they started pretty poorly and then they went on a crazy run and then once they were up there, they never looked back. So anything could happen, really. But I think at the very least, you've got to think playoffs, really.
Mm-hmm. A season's definitely not won in 15 games, no. But obviously, you know, naturally, we can't be extremely optimistic and, you know, totally have our hearts and minds set on getting first or second when you're currently sat seventh in the league after 15 games. But as you say there, Luton got off to a fairly slow start last season, and it wasn't until the turn of the new year that started to really like rapidly climb up the division. By giving Parkinson just that bit more time, maybe even giving a bit more time to recruit more to his tastes in the January window, you know, is there reason to assume that we could get like one of those ridiculous runs together? That we could, like, is there in his style of play in our team reason to assume that we can do what Luton did?
Well, there's no reason to think otherwise, really. I mean, he's improved us massively with just tactics. He hasn't got his own players or anyone really. So, like you say, if I know, like Craig touched on earlier, January is a tough window because people don't want to let people go halfway through a season. So you either get someone you don't want or pay premium prices, really. But even if he gets one or two players in that he maybe worked with in the past or he knows or his type of player, with the improvements he's made already, we could quite easily kick on and go on him. Even if you win like five games in a row, we did that under Ross, do you know what I mean? You do something like that, you get it's all about confidence, really. You get the confidence flowing and the performances like we have and the results will come. So it's definitely not over yet. It's not even close to being over, but you do also have to be realistic. But it's looking like playoffs, but easily you could be up there near the end of the season. I think December and January are interesting months because you've got typically a lot of games, a lot of travelling usually. So if you come out into February being up there, there's no reason why you can't kick on towards the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. Well, on a similar note to looking ahead to, say, January, February, we've got a question from Ben Reeves, who asks that January's only round the corner. What business, if any, do you think we need to do? So we'll go straight back to you, Sam, and then we'll go to you, Craig, but we'll start with you, Sam.
It's hard, really, because I do genuinely think the business we did under Ross in the summer was quite good. Like Craig said, leaders, you look at Dobson, Willis, they've looked great. Lynch has looked good as well. Sort of the obvious one maybe is a striker, but who we're going to get, you know what I mean? Who's going to let their main goal scorer go in January? And do I have the money as well? I know with the investment and that, but it's hard because we do have three strikers at the minute who they all do different jobs well, but they all have flaws in the game as well. So if we can get even one of them firing or two scoring a few goals, would be all right. So depends really if Parkinson will know better than anyone if out of the three of them, McNulty, White or Greg, if they're good enough, then he's fine. But he'll know if we need to get a new striker in. So maybe striker and maybe a backup winger, like Craig said, because we've got injuries. You look at Gooch, you look at Watmore, he's always going to be touch and go, isn't he? McGeady's of an age where he could pick up a knock. So maybe a winger, just a bit of pace and direct, like we had someone like Lewis Morgan last year, who was always in and around the team. I know he might not have played that well, but he was always a decent player to come off the bench or start a game if someone was injured. So maybe improving in that department.
What are you thinking, Craig?
Yeah, I think realistically in January, we're not going to see the club go out and spend a lot of money. That's not what this investment is about in the club. You know, there's things like in the academy and the infrastructure of the club that's going to be improved with the investment money. It should allow for a bit of movement in the transfer window, but not huge amounts. We've got to remember in League One that, of course, it's the SCMP, I think it's called, salary cap management protocol, which, of course, Sunderland have to be wary of. So, of course, they have the Premier League parachute payments still coming in this season, so they are allowed to be a bit more than where the wage is currently. But of course, the end this season, so next season, if Sunderland is still in League One, they can't allow the wage budget to exceed what it currently is. And so the EFL would kind of be looking very strictly upon Sunderland suddenly just splurging a lot of money in the January transfer window, because they look very long term now after what happened at Bolton and Bury at the AFL. It's not just a case of, oh, well, okay, it's within the protocol at the moment because of your parachute payments, so it's fine, do that. They would ask, well, how do you sustain that in the long term? If you're bringing this player in and say giving him a 3-year contract, how do you continue to play that contract for the full 3 years? So I don't think we should expect Sunderland to make any huge splurges in January because of this investment. I think what they do in January could be quite very important to the season. A couple of shrewd signings, I think, would be really good. Whether he looks at a striker or not, I'm not sure. Again, like you say, I think you're spot on, Sam. It'll be Partington himself will know whether he fancies the three strikers that are currently there, and that'll maybe decide whether he does look for another striker or not. But for me, I think a winger with a bit of pace is key for Sunderland. Anything you get from Watmore, I'd love to see the kid stay fit and have a good long run in the team, but anything you get from him should be a bonus, really. And then beyond Watmore, you've got McGeady. Maguire's not a natural winger, but he can play on the wing. And then Gooch as well. And they're your only options as wingers. When you're playing now this 4-2-3-1 system, you need a lot of forward players and something, as I say, a bit different, because Sunderland need to change things up in the final third. So I think an attacking kind of winger, number 10 player, will be my kind of priority for January. I think the obvious choice, everyone will mention the name Marcus Maddison. I think he'd be Keats. And I think Sunderland would be competing up where Ipswich are if Marcus Maddison was in that team. Now, I can understand why in the summer Sunderland didn't go for Marcus Maddison. I think his release clause at Peterborough is around 2.5, 2.6 million. So if you consider that, plus, say, for example, the PM £500,000 for the year, the value of that transfer would be £3 million in the summer. Now, no offence to Marcus Maddison, but he's not worth £3 million when he's only got a year left on his Peterborough contract. What happens in January will be interesting. Will Peterborough get itchy feet and think, oh, we don't want to lose him on a free transfer and dramatically lower that asking price? Sunderland will keep an eye on that. I know they will. And if Peterborough do lower that asking price, perhaps they will be tempted to make a cash bid. But if not, I know for certain that if he goes for free next summer, Sunderland will be looking to kind of get in on that race, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of competition, but the value of that transfer will be a lot more lucrative to Sunderland if they're not paying a transfer fee for Marcus Maddison. And then see, he might ask for a little bit. That's the way it works. They run the contracts down, these players, and then they can ask for a little bit extra on the wages. It's what Jordan Willis did this summer at Coventry. So say they have to pay him a little bit extra in wages, and say, for example, they pay him instead of £500,000 a year, £650,000 a year. Well, that's still the value of that transfer for a year is £650,000 to Sunderland rather than £3 million. And whatever Marcus Maddison is then worth, say he's worth £2.5 million, well, you've got an asset at your club there where you're essentially in profit. So that's the kind of way Sunderland are looking at transfers at the minute, and how they're kind of balancing, you know, financial fair play and SCMP and all that kind of thing, because it is a very confusing thing the way it works in the AFL. You've of course got the Championship where it's financial fair play that you've got to meet there. So Sunderland are kind of looking at the need to meet the League One standards, but they also need to think about long-term. If they get to the Championship, splurge a lot of money now, they can only lose £13 million a year when they go up to the Championship. So if they went up to the Championship and they've splurged all this money on League One quality players, they're then left in a similar position that they used to have when they were in the Premier League, where they've got a lot of players who are not quite up to the standard that they're playing, but they've spent a lot of money on these players and no other teams are taking them off them. So they've got to continue paying them. They then can't afford to bring in better quality players that would improve them at the level they're then at. So the recruitment is really difficult for Sunderland at the moment, and they've just got to do it wisely. It wouldn't surprise me if it's kind of, I know it's not everyone's favourite thing, but January might be a couple of loan players trying to get the right ones in. And as long as those loan players, you know, you do see plenty of young players come from Premier League teams on loan to League One and do very well in this at this level. Sunderland just haven't quite picked the right ones in the past. So that's why I think January will be key. The players that they get have to be right, and if they are, then there's no reason why Sunderland can't have a very good second half of the season.
Absolutely, Craig. Yeah. So we're coming towards the end of the podcast now. We have two final little sections just before we cap off. Obviously, we're looking ahead finally to the Leicester under-21s game in the so formidably named Leasing.com trophy that I never get tired of mentioning. And then we have the Gillingham in the cup on Saturday, I believe it is, if I can get my words out. But yeah, we have those two games approaching, so I'm going to go around the table now and I'll ask you both just for your score predictions for those games, just what you think the scores will be. So, Craig, what do you think the score will be in the Leicester game, and then what do you think the score will be in the Gillingham game?
I don't know a lot about Leicester under-21s, I must admit.
It's not many people's area of expertise, I don't think.
But I think there'll be a lot of changes for the game, and I'll go 2-0 Sunderland for that one. Gillingham, I'll go 2-0 Sunderland again in that one. Nice.
Good
and
stuff.
Easy.
What about you, Sam?
It's hard to call, but you'd like to see a few changes. I'd like to see someone like McGeoch play, get a good run in the team. He should be running the midfield against under-21s. That would be nice to see. I'd say probably agree with Craig. 2-0, pretty comfortable. Might take our foot off the gas. There's no reason to go for it as long as we've got the win. And then Gillingham's similar, but you obviously want to win every game. Like Craig said, the FA Cup, you get a financial boost for getting through the games. So I'm going to go 2-1 on Saturday against Gillingham.
Fair enough. Good stuff. I would go for a 3-1 win against Leicester. I think we'll play some fringe players, which would be the better team because we have, you know, senior players, and that'll make the difference. And then against Gillingham, I'm going to go for a 1-0 win. I'm just going to go for that. I feel like it'll be all right. I feel like, again, it'll be a bit second string, but we'll have enough on the day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we'll leave that there for today. That's all good stuff. So thank you once again for listening to the Roker Report podcast, and thank you for Sunderland Uni for once again supplying us with a place to record the Roker Report podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and leave a 5-star review if you would be so kind. Thank you to Craig for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me. Enjoyed it.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. And thank you, Sam, once again.
Yeah, thanks, travellers. Always a pleasure.
Certainly is. Okie doke, thank you very much and good night.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.